Today in Studio 360, the game is afoot.
What's that?
With Sherlock Holmes back in movie theaters, the film's director, Guy Ritchie, helps us with the case.
It's kind of a 19th century James Bond. There's something there to both titillate the spirit and the intellect.
We'll also hear how Sherlock Holmes inspired one of my favorite shows on TV, House, a detective with a stethoscope.
You're orange, you moron.
In the real world, a character like this would not be tolerated, although the world does tolerate genius.
Also on the scene, Encyclopedia Brown.
He charges 25 cents a case, which is a little bit preposterous, but in 1961, 25 cents a case was adequate.
And later this hour, punk rock goddess Patti Smith.
I've never been interested in a career. I've always been interested in doing something great.
I'm Kurt Anderson, and that is all ahead today in Studio 360, right after this.
You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Later today, I'll talk with the punk poet Patti Smith. But first,
Petri Wine brings you Basil Rathbone and Nigel Bruce in The New Adventures of Sherlock Holmes.
A terrible crime's been committed here in Studio 360. A thief has robbed our safe. The safe where we store all our public radio tote bags. Can you describe the suspect, Holmes?
Well, he's a tall man. The width of his stride indicates that, and he's thin. Our thief dabbles extensively in chemicals, as indicated by the tarnishing of the knob on the safe, and he's obviously in close contact with the criminal classes.
Just amazing, Holmes. But it sounds almost as if you could be describing yourself.
The dividing line between the criminal and the criminal investigator is thinner than you might imagine, my dear doctor.
Yes, but have you any inkling who stole our tote bags?
As soon as I get an answer to my telegrams, I'll explain the whole thing to you.
Very well then, Holmes.
I think that's enough excitement for one day, don't you? After all, I am supposed to be taking a holiday.
For this holiday weekend, Hollywood has a present for us. Robert Downey Jr. starring as Sherlock Holmes with Jude Law as Watson.
I never complain. When do I complain about you practicing the violin at 3 a.m? Or your mess? Your general lack of hygiene or the fact that you steal my clothes?
I understand. Do you? What you need is rest.
There's not that much 19th century pop culture that still plays so well.
Holmes, if I were to go to the country, it would be with my future wife.
Well, certainly if we must.
No, not you.
Sir Arthur Conan Doyle introduced Sherlock Holmes in a Victorian magazine called Beaton's Christmas Annual in 1887. Since then, there have been hundreds of adaptations, plays, movies, radio dramas, TV shows. But Holmes is not stuck in the past. WNYC's Sarah Montague looked at how the character keeps changing with the times.
From an acting point of view, it's like a tightrope of a part.
David Stewart Davies is the author of several books about the screen career of Sherlock Holmes.
Murder?
There's no doubt about it in my mind. Or perhaps I should say in my imagination, but that's where crimes are conceived and where they're solved.
You have to do so much. You have to be cold and arrogant, but at the same time charismatic and likable. And it's a very difficult thing. Many, many great actors have tried playing Holmes and failed.
The stories were written carelessly with many contradictory details. Nevertheless, Holmes turned out to be the Hamlet of detective fiction, a rite of passage, a proving ground.
Conan Doyle created an incomplete portrait of Holmes in his creation of the character. It's rather like one of those paintings by numbers, pictures with some of the segments left blank.
The first great theatrical Holmes was William Gillette, an American actor who premiered his play Sherlock Holmes in 1899. It was Gillette who introduced the iconic trappings most people associate with Holmes, the ubiquitous deerstalker, the curvy pipe and brocade dressing gown, and his naturalistic acting style gave Conan Doyle's acerbic Victorian gentleman a matinee idol appeal. But Holmes evolved with the times, and when Basil Rathbone stepped onto the moors in the 1939 Hound of the Baskervilles, It was with the keen fervor of a wartime champion.
For the British, he seemed wholly England, standing personified against whatever foe.
Sherlockian scholar Susan Rice.
He was sure of himself, and at a time of an enormous turmoil, isn't that what you seek? The sure hand to pull you up out of the abyss.
Make no mistake, Watson. This is not a duel of intellect with a cruel but single-minded Gestapo killer. This is our greatest problem. With England as the stake, and our antagonist, Professor Moriarty.
With the Nazis vanquished, Holmes receded to the realm of schoolboy classics, and the complacent 1950s couldn't quite pull him off the page. He revived in the restless decades that followed, and something had changed.
I think today, what we celebrate in Sherlock Holmes is not so much the heroism. Instead, it's the determined outsider.
Leslie Klinger, author of The New Annotated Sherlock Holmes.
Holmes is a loner. Holmes bucks the system. Holmes is independent. He doesn't necessarily follow the law. He takes the law into his own hands.
And in the 1976 film The 7% Solution, he has an emblematic countercultural weakness. Here's Nicole Williamson's Holmes battling cocaine addiction with the help of Sigmund Freud.
Who am I that your friends should wish us to meet?
Beyond the fact that you are a brilliant Jewish physician who was born in Hungary and studied for a while in Paris, and that certain radical theories of yours have alienated the respectable medical community so that you have severed your connections with various hospitals and branches of the medical fraternity, beyond this I can deduce little.
Today we probably diagnose him as bipolar, vast mood swings, depending on whether he has a case in front of him.
As it happens, the next great Holmes was bipolar.
My mind rebels at stagnation. Give me problems. Give me work. Give me the most abstruse cryptogram, the most intricate analysis, and I'm in my proper atmosphere. But I abhor the dull routine of existence.
Jeremy Brett breathed new life into Holmes in 41 lush TV adaptations of the original Conan Doyle stories, beginning in 1984. Brett's own manic depression colored and sometimes undermined his performances, which swung from taut to grandiose, but gave him a unique perspective on a character he felt was as fragile as he was. Here's Brett in an 80s television interview.
I've always thought Holmes was a sort of damaged penguin or a kind of black beetle. I never thought he was heroic at all. Yeah. I wouldn't cross the road to meet him. And I found him an enormous strain to play. He is a very dark private man.
Tomorrow, at midday, the world as you know it will end.
Well, there isn't any time to waste then, is there?
Or not so dark and private.
It's kind of a 19th century James Bond.
Director Guy Ritchie describes his pyrotechnic new film, Sherlock Holmes, as polarized, using fast-paced contemporary film techniques to reflect Holmes' dual nature.
You should feel his antipathy toward being left with his own thoughts for too long. It's not a unique idea that geniuses are flawed. They're proportionate to the shine is proportionate to the shade.
And who better to embody shine and shade than Robert Downey Jr., whom Ritchie says was designed to play this role. He cites a dazzling, raging bull-like fight scene as an example of what he calls Downey's Holmes-o-vision.
Which is Robert's almost autistic ability to induce an enormous amount of information.
First, distract target. Then block his blind jab. Counter with cross to left cheek. Heel kick to diaphragm. In summary, ears ringing, jaw fractured, 3 ribs cracked, 4 broken, physical recovery 6 weeks, full psychological recovery 6 months, capacity to spit it back of head neutralized.
He's both esoteric and accessible. You know, he's a multidimensional character. There's something there to both titillate the spirit and the intellect.
Here dwell together still two men of note, who never lived and so can never die, wrote the poet Vincent Starrett in his 1942 sonnet, 221B Baker Street. The poem concludes, here, though the world explode, these two survive. And it is always 1895. It is up to Robert Downey Jr. to demonstrate that he is the 21st century Holmes, and that it is always 1895. For Studio 360, I'm Sarah Montague.
Sherlock Holmes, starring Robert Downey Jr., is out this weekend. The new movie is just the latest addition to a staggering amount of Holmesiana out there. And the Fort Knox of all that material is at the Sherlock Holmes Archive. Surprisingly, that archive is not in London, but at the University of Minnesota. Rather, under the University of Minnesota in its rare book collection. Sarah Lemanchik took the elevator down to see it.
So we're going down to the Holy of Holies.
Way down.
It seems only fitting that the world's largest Sherlock Holmes collection is kept in secret, buried some 9 stories below the earth.
So, yeah, we're 85 feet underground. You'll notice it's a little cooler down here.
Walking into the library's limestone caverns, I was hoping for echoing stone steps and flickering wall sconces. So, I was a little unprepared for the Hitler's bunker feel of the place. Still,
here we are.
The locks were pretty cool.
This is Bay 6.
Tim Johnson is the curator of special collections and rare books at the University of Minnesota.
We've got the good, the bad, and the ugly here.
And really, he's not kidding. Original manuscript page from The Hound of the Baskervilles? Good.
Doyle had pretty clear handwriting for a doctor.
Then,
these are
the marionettes.
Covered up by Raggedy Ann and Andy that are also dressed up as Sherlock and Dr. Watson. Very dapper.
Yeah, but is there anything strange?
We've got bars of soap that are carved sculptures of Sherlock Holmes done by prisoners in prison.
Okay, that is strange. Standing knee-deep in matchboxes and tea towels, you can see how the character evolved, for better or worse.
We've also got the Sesame Street character, Sherlock Hemlock, as a needlepoint pillow saying, "Egad."
Egad, the hunt's afoot. Show me the clues.
Why, who are you?
Sherlock Hemlock, the world's greatest detective.
OMG, my first brush with Holmes was the case of the missing chicken salad sandwich.
Whoever ate your sandwich doesn't like bread crust.
I mean, that's part of the icon. You've got the magnifying glass, the hat, the pipe. You see those three things, you know you're talking Sherlock.
But for the university, talk is cheap. They want action.
Now, 1 year they wanted me to get dressed up as Sherlock Holmes and be at the state fair and talk about the collection. I said, there's no way I'm going to stand out at the fairgrounds in 90-degree heat in a full woolen Inverness cape and a deerstalker hat.
Johnson wore the hat and shorts. 85 feet below Minnesota, I'm Sarah Lemanchik for Studio 360.
85 feet below Minnesota would be a good name for a band. I'm Kurt Anderson, and coming up, we'll hear how Holmes turned into House.
And the sign in the bathroom says that employees must wash after using the facilities, but I figured that somebody who wipes snot on a sleeve isn't hyper-concerned about sanitary conditions.
That's all ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360, and today we're asking the question, what up, Holmes? You may not realize it, but Sherlock Holmes is all over primetime television. Law and Order, CSI, Cold Case. And probably the single character most indebted to Holmes isn't a detective at all. He's the diagnostic physician, Dr. Gregory House.
Differential diagnosis, people. If it's not a tumor, what are the suspects? Why couldn't she talk?
Aneurysm, stroke, or some other ischemic syndrome.
Get her a contrast MRI.
Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease?
Mad cow.
Mad zebra.
Wernicke's encephalopathy.
No. Blood thymine level was normal.
Lab in Trenton could have screwed up the blood test. I assume it's a corollary of people lie that people screw up.
Redraw the blood tests and get her scheduled for that contrast MRI ASAP. Let's find out what kind of zebra we're treating here.
Dr. House is played by Hugh Laurie, and House's creator is David Shore, who's here with me today. When did viewers start making the Sherlock Holmes connection and saying, what's he doing here?
You know, good question. People have been trickling into that concept since day one. Instead of Holmes and Watson, we have House and Wilson. And he lives at 221, not Baker Street, but apartment B. And
And there are so many. And the drug problem. And the arrogance. And the, you know, brilliant inductive reasoning. And the no serious romantic relationship. And so much more.
And the greater concern for the truth than for the humanity of the situation. You know, it was all about rationality to him. That was probably the biggest thing. That was the thing that I really wanted to do with the character. And as I was doing with the character, I realized I was sort of ripping off Arthur Conan Doyle. So I thought I'd give him a little credit.
Well, and of course, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle was a physician.
And not only was he a physician, and this is a story that Hugh Laurie brought to my attention. While we were shooting the pilot, Hugh Laurie came to me and explained a story about that he had read about Joseph Bell. That Joseph Bell, who was a professor of Arthur Conan Doyle's in medical school, was in fact the inspiration for Sherlock Holmes. He was a doctor who would go around and look at a patient and deduce what was wrong with that patient and deduce things about that patient from little tiny clues concerning that patient, which of course is what we have House doing. So in fact, House is a doctor who was inspired by a detective who was inspired by a doctor.
Well, in fact, funny you should mention Dr. Bell. We have a recording here of Arthur Conan Doyle from 1930, recorded not long before he died, and I want to play it for you.
Oh, fantastic.
Reading some detective stories, I was struck by the fact that their results were obtained in nearly every case by chance. I thought I would try my hand at writing a story where the hero would treat crime as Dr. Bell treated disease, and where science would take the place of chance. The result was Sherlock Holmes, and I confess that result has surprised me very much.
I have never heard Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. That was fantastic.
Like Holmes, House is this remarkably good judge of character. Even though he has a rotten bedside manner. I want to play a scene in which House meets a patient whose skin has this odd orangey color, even though the guy has come in complaining about back pain.
I was playing golf and my cleats got stuck. I mean, it hurt a little, but I kept playing. The next morning, I could barely stand up. Well, you're smiling, so I take it that means this isn't serious. What's that? What are you doing?
Painkillers.
Oh, for your leg.
No, because they're yummy. You want one? Make your back feel better. Unfortunately, you have a deeper problem. Your wife is having an affair.
What?
You're orange, you moron. It's one thing for you not to notice, but if your wife hasn't picked up on the fact that her husband has changed colors, she's just not paying attention. By the way, do you consume just a ridiculous amount of carrots and megadose vitamins? Carrots turn you yellow, the niacin turns you red. Find some finger paint and do the math. And get a good lawyer.
You know, this is a guy coming in because he's got back pain. And House doesn't simply jump to the fact that he's turned orange and doesn't even simply jump to the fact that he's been consuming vitamins and carrots. He goes beyond that to the fact that the man's wife has been having an affair.
Yeah.
In the real world, a character like this would not be tolerated, although the world does tolerate genius. You know, if you are smart enough and get results that are good enough, people will put up with a lot.
And would that the world embraced rationality more than it in fact does.
Exactly. It's very, very true.
So much about House is like a police procedural more than any conventional doctor show we've ever seen.
Yes, he's very much a detective. And that was the original concept of the show to some extent, was a police procedural in a hospital, a CSI in a hospital where the germs are the suspects. And it's all about deductive reasoning and finding the clues and finding the answer, which to some extent is what doctors do. And certainly it's what this doctor does in the Department of Diagnostic Medicine. To begin with, I think there was this potential pitfall for the show of being too enamored of the science, even though, as I said, it's all about rationality. It still is that. It is the character. It is that character that I think drives this show. It is not, which particular disease the person's dying of each week. Germs don't have motives. Half of what Sherlock Holmes figured out was why people did it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he would certainly figure out who did it and how they did it, but why they do things. So why done it, usually.
Have you seen the new movie?
I'm looking forward to seeing it. I haven't seen it.
Yeah.
And it was strange. When I saw a trailer once, I was going to see another movie, and the trailer for Sherlock Holmes comes on, and there was something about it, and I'm not sure what it was, and it wasn't like they ripped us up, but there was something about the tone that I just went, that feels like my show.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went, oh, well, I guess they earned it. It is Sherlock Holmes are crying out loud.
There you go. David Shore, thanks very much.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
David Shore is the creator of House, which is now in its sixth season. Conan Doyle wrote dozens of Sherlock Holmes stories over 40 years, but he took 3 years off from May 1891 to May 1894. And some Holmes fans have taken it upon themselves to try to fill in that blank in the detective's career. They call it the Great Hiatus.
That hiatus is there, and I think everybody who's read about it has thought, what really did happen?
That's Ted Riccardi. He used the Great Hiatus as an opportunity to fictionally send Holmes on adventures through Tibet and Nepal, India and Indonesia.
Doyle refers to it in the story in which Holmes comes back, and he says that Holmes was in Lhasa for 2 years.
Riccardi knows his stuff. He's a retired professor of Middle Eastern and Asian languages, and he lives in Kathmandu. His book of fiction is called The Oriental Casebook of Sherlock Holmes.
As you know, Watson, I have a certain facility with languages. I had picked up a good deal of Tibetan in the monasteries, and even studied the ancient Tibetan practice of concentrating bodily heat. It is a most useful and extraordinary technique, which I can still perform on occasion. Indeed, it saved me from 2 serious misadventures in the mountains, from which I might have frozen to death.
I did need someone for Holmes to relate to. A couple of times I used the character Gorashar, his name is, the Tibetan name. Gorashar befriends Holmes in Lhasa and winds up functioning the way Watson does in a couple of stories.
It was well within his first fortnight that Holmes met Gorashar, the most successful merchant of Lhasa and someone who was to be of invaluable aid to him. He welcomed Holmes warmly, offering him a rare Russian cigarette, and Holmes felt at once comfortable in his presence. In the evening, Holmes soon learned, Gorashar's lavish home near the Jokhang became the site of an elaborate salon, which almost all of the peculiar denizens of the city attended. The air was always thick with the smoke of tobacco and Indian gunja, and the ears were often assaulted by a band of Indian musicians from Calcutta, who attempted peculiar Oriental renditions of the seductive ditties that one associates with the demi-monde establishments of London and Paris.
I put a lot of things in Sherlock Holmes's head that were not there when Doyle wrote about him. Sanskrit is only one of those things.
Each syllable of the word Kali had a dot-like mark after it, something unknown in the Indian scripts, and the word Rashtra was followed by a small dash-like sign, as if the word were incomplete. Perhaps the message would have been longer had the murderers not been interrupted during the writing.
What I did with the identity was simply to put him in Asian garb, so to speak, in Oriental garb, that was consistent with the way he acted in London.
A rather devilish grin broke out on Gorashar's face. He revealed to Holmes the easiest way to enter undetected. Dressed as a monk, Holmes should have no difficulty entering and then moving about, for there were few guards inside, and the patrols passed only once every 2 hours.
He knows costumery, so all he has to do is put on a Tibetan robe or do whatever he has to do to look like an Indian or a Sikh or a Brahmin or whatever. He can do it all. He knows the tricks, and he's an actor. Holmes is a very, very, very good actor, and sometimes he fools the natives, sometimes he doesn't.
Riccardi is the author of The Oriental Casebook of Sherlock Holmes. Studio 360's Michelle Siegel produced our story. So, Sherlock Holmes has been through almost every possible transformation. Ted Riccardi sent him to Kathmandu. and Donald J. Sobel turned him into Leroy Brown. Brown is a bookish fifth grader who runs a detective agency out of his parents' garage. You probably know him by his nickname, Encyclopedia. Sobel likes to call him Sherlock Holmes in sneakers. And Studio 360's Derek John went to pay this Sobel fellow a visit.
Looking for clues to the author Donald J. Sobel, I fished out my old dog-eared copy of Encyclopedia Brown and the Case of the Disgusting Sneakers, number 18 in the series. A neighborhood kid named Phoebe hires Encyclopedia to find out who swiped her sweaty, smelly sneakers. Idaville's annual Disgusting Sneaker Contest was just around the corner, and Phoebe had been a shoe-in until her funky footwear went missing.
I need to change my shirt very often. I can tell you, you sit there and you perspire until finally you stop bleeding blood, you start bleeding perspiration, and then you get your story. You know, it's just a question of working it out.
Sobel has been working it out for almost 50 years now. The case of the missing roller skates, the case of the knife and the watermelon, 250 mysteries and counting. And like our hero, the author seems to have a limitless capacity for random facts.
A lot of people told me when the first book came out that it wouldn't be popular. Name was putting off. Big word, encyclopedia. No kid is going to enjoy a book with a name like that, and no youngster's going to take it off the shelf.
Sure enough, 24 publishers rejected Encyclopedia Brown, Boy Detective. But in 1963, Random House picked it up, and an American original was born.
Mr. and Mrs. Brown had one child. They called him Leroy, and so did his teachers. Everyone else in Idaville called him Encyclopedia. He was like a complete library, walking around in sneakers. Old ladies who did crossword puzzles were always stopping him on the street to ask him questions.
Sherlock Holmes is the number one mystery detective. You don't compete with Sherlock Holmes.
And yet, Sobel couldn't help himself. He took to calling Encyclopedia Sherlock Holmes in sneakers. And of course, he had a Watson.
Well, Sally Kimball is the junior partner. And at that time, there was a television show emanating from England called The Avengers. And the woman, Diana Riggs, was a karate expert.
I'm interested in karate.
She handled a rough going. Of course, in this period of time, 1960, 61, it wasn't fashionable for a girl or woman to work up a sweat.
Encyclopedia isn't exactly a wuss, but Sally is definitely the brawn of the operation. Together, they foil the nefarious schemes of every bully in town. Think Revenge of the Nerds, but 20 years earlier.
The first problem I had with the book was how to make Encyclopedia Brown likable. Because I remember from my school days, the smartest kid in the class was a nice kid, but he didn't have close friends. People shied away from him. So I had to work at that, and I had to make him modest, and I had to make him upright. He doesn't charge a fortune. He charges 25 cents a case, which is a little bit preposterous, but in 1961, 25 cents a case was adequate. Now, it's funny.
Which raises an interesting point. Idaville, the all-American town with the annual Disgusting Sneaker Contest, remains virtually unchanged today. Same with the author, who still relishes his wisecracking kids and corny one-liners.
Bugs Meany was the leader of the Tigers, a gang of older boys who caused more trouble than itching powder in Friday's wash.
I don't know. Did that get by?
If Sobel hasn't changed his tune, it's maybe because he doesn't have to. Every year, there's a new generation of 10-year-olds browsing juvenile fiction, just waiting to discover the boy detective.
A kid really isn't interested in the author. And a kid doesn't go to cocktail parties and discuss children's books. And a kid doesn't want an author to solve the mysteries of the universe or how we're going to get rid of pollution. He wants or she wants a good story, and that's what they want.
Unlike Nancy Drew or the Hardy Boys, Sobel's never had an army of ghostwriters to help him come up with a good story. But at age 85, he's barely lost a step. Even as an adult, I often found myself flipping to the back of the book to see how Encyclopedia solved the case yet again.
I like the character. He's part of the family. Four kids. and he was the fifth kid in the family. He was the breadwinner. You know, where do you get a breadwinner at 10 years old? You got to hang on to him.
For Studio 360, I'm Derek John.
Donald J. Sobel's latest book, Encyclopedia Brown's Super Sleuth, number 25 in the series, is in bookstores now. All month long, we've been highlighting this year's entries in the National Recording Registry. That's the Library of Congress program that preserves key moments in recording history for all time. This week, the George Jones hit He Stopped Loving Her Today, a song really so sad that Jones almost didn't record it. And then it became the Country Music Association's Song of the Year, 2 years in a row. To tell the story, we have a Nashville insider.
My name is Hazel Smith. Country music has been my life all my life. I do a column called Hot Dish for CMT.com, and this is my 15th year of reporting country music news to WFMS in Indianapolis.
The star who recorded the song...
Well, my name is George Jones, and I've been in country music now for many years, ever since about 1956.
And the songwriter, one of the greats.
My name is Bobby Braddock, and I write songs. I guess some of the songs I've written that country music fans would be familiar with would be Time Marches On, Tracy Lawrence, and then Tammy Wynette's D-I-V-O-R-C-E.
Our
You know, you got a man like Bobby Braddock who wrote, I don't know how many hits for George Jones, Golden Rings and a lot of songs. Now, those were duets with George and Tammy. You know that, don't you?
In a pawn shop in Chicago on a sunny summer day.
Bobby wrote songs that suited George. The Possum Can Sing.
She smiles and nods her head as he says, honey, that's for you. It's not much. But it's the best that I can do.
When I start singing, I try to live that story and put every bit of heart and soul that I had to offer in the songs. And that's the way I've always felt about recording. You know when a song is pretty good, because if it hits you and just blows smoke everywhere, you know it's got something pretty powerful there.
He said, I'll love you till I die. She told him, you'll forget in time. As the years went slowly by, she still preyed upon his mind.
The plot line of He Stopped Loving Her Today, which I wrote with Curly Putman, is this guy split up with the love of his life, and he just never moved on, and he stopped loving her today because he died today, simply put.
But he still loved her through it all.
He never found out anything about the art of letting go.
Hoping she'd come back again.
The guy was a bad role model.
George thought it was the saddest song he ever heard, and wouldn't nobody listen to it.
I kept arguing with my producer. I said, Billy Sherrill was my producer at that time. And I said, Billy, it's a beautiful song. It's just too sad.
Billy Sherrill got a lot of criticism in those days for his production being too slick.
He knew I wasn't much of horns and strings and things like that, but strings are beautiful. I found out.
I can tell you right now, the production of He Stopped Loving Her Today did not hurt that song at all. As a matter of fact, if you listen at it, you start to cry.
My favorite part of the record is the ascending string section. Sounds like the guy has died and is on his way to heaven.
He stopped loving her today. It plays to soon they'll carry him away.
loving her today.
Instead of singing it, Billy Sherrill thought it would be good just to do the recitation.
You know, she came to see him one last time.
You know, it still is the ultimate I love you song, you know.
When George sings the song, the entire audience stands to their feet. They feel like they're in church, do you understand?
This time, he's over her for good. He stopped loving her today.
Country music is the one thing on this planet that is true. And this song, He Stopped Loving Her Today, every word is true. There's no make-believe in it. It's something that, surely to God, it happens sometime.
He stopped loving her today.
The George Jones hit song written by Bobby Braddock. We heard from both of them along with Hazel Smith. Ben Manila and Devin Strolovich produced our story. We've aired four stories about this year's picks for the National Recording Registry at the Library of Congress. They're all available at our website, along with a bonus track, number 5 in the series, a story about Link Wray's Rumble, including guitarist Little Stevie Van Zandt. That's at studio360.org.
In my day, it was a man's game.
Coming up in just a minute, one of my rock and roll idols, Patti Smith.
The greatest rock stars from Bo Diddley, Elvis Presley, to Jimi Hendrix, they're male.
That's just ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. If there is one woman who embodies rock and roll sensibility in its purest form, it is Patti Smith.
Jesus died for somebody's sins, but not mine.
Raw and passionate, gender-bending, non-conforming in all kinds of ways, Patti Smith changed music pretty much forever and has continued to make great records into this decade.
People say beware, but I don't care.
Her life and art are now the subject of a documentary by the photographer Steven Sebring. It's called Patti Smith, Dream of Life, and it airs on PBS next week. I am very happy to have her with me now, Patti Smith. Welcome to Studio 360.
Oh, hello. Thank you.
So Steven Sebring, the maker of this movie, followed you around for 11 years.
Yes, he did. I know it sounds strange, but Stephen came into my life right after a very difficult period. I had lost my husband and my brother. I was a widow with two children, had to make a living. And I also wanted to do a record in memory of him, which was gone again. Naturally, one has to be photographed. And also with the death of Robert Mapplethorpe, I had really lost my greatest collaborator in photography. So I asked, I'd met Michael Stipe, and I asked Michael Stipe if he knew a nice photographer because I hadn't been used to being photographed. I had my children, and I wanted someone who could integrate into my family. And he suggested Steven Sebring. And Steven Sebring knocked on my door, I answered, and I had a new brother.
Really?
It was that simple. He was such a kind, generous person, loved my children. It was as if they had an instant uncle, mm-hmm. and I had also lost my brother, had a new brother.
Yeah. Was the intention or the expectation that it would take as long as it has?
Well, there wasn't anything we were doing.
Uh-huh.
He didn't ask me if he could make a film. He just wanted to gather information, discover. He met me as a mother. He met me in a very humble situation in Detroit. And then he had never seen me perform. And when he did see me perform, he was so astounded by the range between me being a mom doing mm-hmm. dishes and peeling potatoes to performing, he wanted to learn more about me. You're
calling to remind me to call. Life isn't some vertical or horizontal line. You have your own interior world, and it's not neat. Therefore, the importance and the beauty of music, sound, noise. When you go outside and walk on the street, you're hearing traffic, you're hearing people talking, children laughing, birds chirping, someone going by with a boombox, hundreds of different sounds. All of these things are potentially beautiful. The eye sees a bit of the sky, the Empire State Building, the street, your feet as they're walking, the texture of your skin, layer after layer after layer of simple human existence.
That's from the new film about Patti Smith, Patti Smith, Dream of Life. And it's very impressionistic. It's not like a traditional Talking Heads documentary of, Patti Smith, born in 1946.
No, because I don't want that. Yeah. I mean, I'm alive. I don't like documentaries that have a lot of talking heads. And it's all about the present. There is some note of some of my past so people get a sense of place and a bit about where I was at that time of my life. But it's really a document on how I rebuilt my life after losing Robert, my husband, my brother, and my pianist, Richard Soul.
Your 1996 record, Gone Again, is considered by many to be among your strongest work, which you made, as you have described, after losing your brother and your husband in the same year, I guess?
Yeah, within a month.
Let's listen to the song off that album, Beneath the Southern Cross.
Oh, to be not anyone gone. This maze of being skin.
That song, among other things, seems to be about the liberation of death from worldly burdens.
Well, after Fred died, Allen Ginsberg called me up, as I say in the film, and counseled me to let go of the departed and continue life's celebration. And I suppose that song does reflect that idea.
You have influenced a lot of artists, musicians, especially musicians who came of age in the 1970s. I'm thinking of Michael Stipe of R.E.M., for instance. And he's talked about how discovering your music was this huge epiphany for him, an aha moment. And now you're friends and have performed together. How did you come together? How did you meet?
Michael came to me when he heard that I had lost Fred. I didn't even know Michael. He found my number, and he called me. Almost makes me cry. Michael called me on Valentine's Day. He was in Spain. He was a bit intoxicated, which gave him the nerve to call a stranger. And he called me a few months after Fred died to wish me happy Valentine's Day because he thought that it was probably my first Valentine's Day in 20 years without Fred, and it was. And that simple gesture, quite chivalrous and loving, was the beginning of our friendship.
Let's listen to the R.E.M. track, Ebo the Letter, from their 1996 album, New Adventure in Hi-Fi, where you sing backup.
Yes, he dedicated the song to me.
I said your name. I wore it like a batch of teenage film stars, hash bars, cherry mash, and tinfoil tiaras, dreaming of Maria Callas.
tears. It's fake then, I don't get it. I wrap my hand in plastic to try to look through it. Maybelline eyes and girls, boy moves can take you far. A star thing, I don't get it.
And he talks about Maria Callas, who I understand is a big figure in your pantheon.
Yes, she is.
How come? That's sort of a surprising Patti Smith hero.
Well, not if you knew me, because I've loved opera since I was a child. I listen to her all the time. I study her. I mean, of course, I can't sing like that, but she has taught me a lot about discovering how to deliver the inner narrative of a song. Because I listen to her songs, I don't speak Italian or I don't speak whatever language she's singing, but I understand some of what she's conveying through, you know, her emotional interpretation.
Not long ago, I heard you perform, I guess what is probably at this point your most famous song, Because of the Night, which you co-wrote with Bruce Springsteen. That happened in a sort of serendipitous, accidental way, huh?
Yes. Well, I was recording Easter. Jimmy Iovine was my producer, and he had engineered with Bruce. And I had just had a serious accident, and it deterred us from, my band and I, from having time to write songs.
That was when you fell off the stage?
Yes.
Yeah.
And it put me out of action for several months. So we really didn't have a lot of songs. I don't know exactly, you know, who decided that Bruce should offer this song to me. Maybe Jimmy begged him for it. Maybe Bruce wanted to. But I was given this tape, and I didn't listen to it for several weeks because I wanted us to write our own songs. And one night Fred was courting me, and he lived in Detroit, and he was supposed to call me one night, and I waited for this phone call. I just, you know, so excited he was going to call me. And he was an hour late, and then 2 hours late, and then 3 hours late. And I started pacing around waiting for this phone call. And I noticed that the tape was sitting on the mantle. And I thought, whoa, that'll give me something to do. I put it in the cassette player. And when I heard it, I knew immediately. I said it out loud. I said, oh, it's one of those darn hits. I knew that the song would be extremely popular. It was in my key. It was in the key of A, I believe. It was perfectly arranged.
Let's listen to a little bit of it.
Hunger is the fire I breathe. Love is a banquet on which we feed.
It's hard not to, one wants to sing along. And it's funny, when people have hits like that, they often say, no, we had no idea. I'm happy to hear that you said no right away.
No. I knew right away. And all I was going to say at the end was, in waiting for Fred, because he didn't call me till midnight, I wrote the lyrics. I wrote the verse lyrics. And it's when he finally did call me, it's quite funny. I was, you know, upset, but of course also excited and happy that he called me. But in that space of time, I wrote the lyrics to my most popular song.
And did you say thanks for being 3 hours late? Sorry.
No, I don't remember, but I did tell him that I wrote a song for him. And there's a line in the song that says, "Have I doubt when I'm alone? Love is a ring, the telephone." That's waiting for Fred to call me.
That's nice. And you performed that again. I recently saw the rebroadcast of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Oh, at Madison Square Garden. Yeah. Yes, it was great. I sang it with U2 and Bruce. It's still exciting.
Yeah.
When I've sang that song 1,000 times.
Really? And you do get like goosebumps?
Yes. Because cool. You know why? Because the people gets seem so excited and happy, and there's nothing like giving the people something they want. It's the greatest feeling when you can feel they're excited and happy.
Patti Smith, thank you very much.
Okay. Thanks.
You can hear more of my conversation with Patti Smith on our website, studio360.org. The new documentary, Patti Smith, Dream of Life, airs on PBS this Wednesday. And that's it for this week's show. Thanks very much for listening, and I hope you listen again next week. Studio 360 is a co-production of PRI and WNYC. Our production team includes
Julie Burstein,
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Derek John,
Jenny Lawton,
Pike Medinowski,
Rob Weisberg,
Aaron Calabria,
Susie Karlowski,
Jess Siao,
Jordan Sales.
And our theme music is by David Van Tiegum.
Studio 360 is funded in part by Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees. By the SC Group, whose charitable resources include FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds at fjc.org. And by the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. The Sounds of American Culture, our series highlighting works in the National Recording Registry, receives production support from the Library of Congress.
PRI, Public Radio International.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.
Next time in Studio 360, we'll explore time travel in fantasy and real life.
Since you need to already have made the time machine before you can use it, you can't ever go back before it was built.
And the amazing singer Janelle Monáe will perform her 28th century funk.
Left the city, my mama, she said don't come back home.
That's next time in Studio 360 from WNYC and PRI.